At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
We are proud members of the Spy Podcast Network. Find out more at www.spypodcasts.com.
Due to the themes of this podcast, listener discretion is advised.
Only here in Berlin, the heads of two blocks facing each other, the NATO and the Warsaw Pact, were living in one city. They were living door to door next to each other. And because of this, a couple of things were possible in Berlin that could only be done in Berlin.
Lock your doors, close the blinds, change your passwords. This is Secrets and Spies. Secrets and Spies is a podcast that dives into the world of espionage, terrorism, geopolitics, and intrigue. This podcast is produced and hosted by Chris Carr.
On today's podcast, I'm joined by Bernard von Koska, who is the curator of the Allied Museum in Berlin and the co-author of the excellent book Capital of Spies. On this episode, we discuss Capital of Spies that takes a look at the history of Cold War Berlin. Just before we begin, we now have a YouTube channel. I've been threatening it for a while, and now we have it. So please follow the link below in the show notes and subscribe to our YouTube channel. On there are video versions of the podcast. So if you like to see a squiggly line with your interviews, you can now see a squiggly line on YouTube. If you wish to support the podcast, there are a few options for you. You can become a Patreon subscriber and directly support the show for £3 a month. We also have a merchandise store at Redbubble. We have cups, coasters, water bottles, and tote bags all available on the Redbubble store. Also, if you enjoy this episode, please share it on social media among friends, family, colleagues, cohorts. And lastly, please leave a review on your podcast app. All reviews help the show get discovered by other people. Apple Podcasts in particular love reviews, and they really help this show get featured on the app. So please do leave a review. All the links are available in the show notes below. Thank you so much for your support, and without further ado, let's get going.
The opinions expressed by guests on Secrets and Spies do not necessarily represent those of the producers and sponsors of this podcast.
Bernard, welcome to the podcast. Please, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, Chris, thank you for inviting me. I was obviously born in Germany in 1962, and then I studied history and political science and public law in Trier in Germany, and also in Stafford in Great Britain. And since 1994, I'm a member of the academic staff at the Allied Museum in Berlin. And 2 years, I was also the acting director of that museum. And doing the job at the museum, I'm a curator and was responsible for a couple of exhibitions like The Link with Home, that is dealing with Western Allied radio broadcasting stations, AFN and BFBS and BFN. Mission accomplished to Western Allied military liaison missions in Potsdam, and also exhibition on the spy tunnel, and who was a Nazi, and so, and 100 objects Berlin during Cold War. So I did a lot of exhibitions during my last 25 years at the museum, and I also published numerous articles on several subjects, usually Berlin blockade, Berlin airlift. But I'm also the co-author of the book Capital of Spies, and yes, and that's what we are basically talking about.
Yeah, well, can you give us a very, very sort of brief bookshelf summary of what Capital of Spies is about?
Well, it's dealing with the intelligence activities of the Western powers, that was my part, as well as the East Germans, that was the part of the German Berlin journalist I was writing that book with. He's my co-author. His name is Sven Felix Kellerhoff, and he's writing for the national newspaper Die Welt for many, many years and published more than 20 books. So he's an expert on National Socialism and on the GDR. And so we decided to write the book together. I'm doing the one half on the Allies, and he's doing the other half on East Germany. And it's a good overview. We are dealing with a couple of intelligence operations from 1945 to 1990. And this 300 pages will give you a good overview of what happened in Berlin during the Cold War. And yes, I think some of those things we'll talk about today.
Yes, excellent. Well, I think spy books make the best books to read about a city you're going to. And I'm actually planning a trip myself to Berlin later this year. To my shame, I've not really spent much time in Berlin, but I'm going to correct that this year. I have spent a lot of time in Vienna, which we'll talk about shortly. But what is it that drew you to this topic? Because obviously you're incredibly knowledgeable. You've got a lot of sort of background research, you know, your background sort of experience being the head of the Allied Museum and things. So what is it that sort of drew you to this topic? And how do you go about sort of researching the content for your book?
Basically, it was a publisher a person approached me and asked me if I do not want to write a book about espionage in Berlin. And I said, well, yes and no. Yes, I can do one half of the book. And no, it's because I don't know the other side good enough. So that's the reason why we have two authors and why we split that book. And the research is, as I said, I have more than 25 years experience in similar topics for the exhibitions at the Allied Museum. And I had contact to a couple of spies for those exhibitions. And their things they said and the ideas they give me. And obviously, you have a network as a curator in museums, and know where whom you can approach to get a couple of documents. And ironically enough, a lot of information was in the former Stasi documents. So the BSTU, that is the organization who kept the Stasi files after the GDR collapsed, you would find a lot of information in there.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, we briefly touched upon Vienna. So Vienna is obviously often talked about as a major spy city, but your book is arguing that Berlin's more significant. So can you talk to us about the sort of similarities and differences between Berlin and Vienna? And we're sort of looking at 1945 to 55, which is sort of the early days of the Cold War.
Yes, Berlin was not unique because also in Vienna, the four major occupation forces, the Soviet Union, the Americans, the British and the French, share the town, and they all four occupied Vienna as well as Berlin. The only difference in Vienna is there was a neutral zone which did not exist in Berlin. But the other major difference between Vienna and Berlin is that Vienna was not in the middle of the Soviet zone, or later the GDR. So you have a couple of similarities, like all four powers occupied it and shared it, divide the city into their individual zones. But the big difference is that Berlin was encapsulated in the Soviet zone, and which became the GDR later on. But this is a big difference. And Vienna only existed as an occupied city from 1945 to 1955. And after 55, it was only and exclusively Berlin that has this unique status. And the status was unique because only here in Berlin, the heads of the two blocks facing each other, the NATO and the Warsaw Pact, were living in one city. They were living door to door next to each other. And because of this, a couple of things were possible in Berlin that could only be done in Berlin. And I think we will have a few examples for that later.
Yeah. Well, definitely. I suppose that close proximity gives a lot of opportunity for sort of, what's the word I want? So, well, not just covert relationships, but a sort of background, behind the scenes diplomacy, just based on sort of interpersonal relations.
But Berlin was indeed also the blueprint for a lot of things that also happened in Berlin. For example, we have knowledge that in Austria, the CIA paid their informants between $130 and $100 or $200 full-time informants. And we know that this kind of money was also paid in Berlin. And also later on, we will learn that the Allies were trying to listen to the Soviet telephone conversation, and in the cellars in Vienna, they were digging, they're breaking walls and digging little tunnels, and a tunnel of 7 meters in Vienna, and that was called Operation Silver, was also the blueprint for a much bigger tunnel later in Berlin.
Yeah. Well, can you talk to us a bit about those sort of early Western intelligence efforts in Berlin, and sort of, you know, sort of prior to the wall being constructed? What information were Western intelligence services sort of looking for, and how did they go about obtaining it?
When I got into the subject, I was more or less shocked when I noticed, or when I read that the people active at the time were more or less blind about the other side. Keeping in mind that in 1941, the Americans had no interest in the Soviet Union at all. This was on another planet. So they had no information about the Soviet Union. When they entered the war, it was not the Soviet Union they were aiming at. It was obviously the Third Reich and Nazi Germany they were aiming at, and the Soviet Union was the ally. So again, after entering the Second World War, they had no aim to get any basic intelligence on an ally. So then all of a sudden, the end of the Second World War came. And all of a sudden, in 46, of at least 47, it was obvious that the former allies do not work together that well. And then, obviously, it was the big question. So, what do we know about the other side? And I can tell you that the Russians knew much more about the Americans than the Americans knew about Russia. And for that reason, the Americans started to employ former people from the German Wehrmacht, because the German Wehrmacht had indeed knowledge about military things that were going on in Russia, because the Germans need to know that when they started war against Russia, they need to know who the enemy was. And when the Americans learned they don't know anything about it, they were starting to hire former high-ranking officers of the Wehrmacht who were involved in the intelligence against Russia. And it was, as I said, it was more or less shocking to learn that at the time they don't even have, until 1947, they don't even have a single Secret Service officer in Berlin who can speak the Russian language.
Yeah, that was quite shocking when I read that. I was like, wow.
and also that any kind of peace they obtained from behind the Iron Curtain, they could not even cross-check it with other sources, because there were no other sources. And also very shocking that even minimum knowledge, like what did they say when they came up with a telephone book or with the latest map of the other side, this was a big thing. So actually you can say the Americans did know very little about the Soviet Union when they were in Berlin, and when they noticed that no longer the Germans but probably the Soviet Union will be the next enemy.
And the Russian intelligence picture was quite complex. It was so obscure that the CIA found it very difficult to kind of get a clear picture and verify the information, like you were saying. So can you give us a kind of quick guide to sort of that Russian intelligence picture sort of during 1945 to 1955? Because there were quite a few agencies and it was slowly amalgamated into one, didn't they?
Well, ironically enough, the structure of the Russian intelligence was so confusing that even some Soviet reports were mixing up the areas of responsibility. And also as a result of that, the American side remained completely in the dark when it came to understand who is responsible for what. And so you have, for example, the NKGB, the People's Commissary for State Security, the MGB, the Ministry for State Security, then the KGB, and parallel to those organizations for a couple of years, you have the KE, which is the Committee of Information, and all of that was very confusing. That was one point. And the other point is that until even many, many years later, they could not put a face to a name. Even if they had the name of a Russian representative of one of those organizations, they couldn't put a face to it.
Wow, that's crazy.
So that happened to that. That's a funny story when Markus Wolf, which is the spy master of East Germany, in the 70s, and he's from the late 50s. He is a high-ranking officer in East German intelligence. And for nearly 20 years, they know the name, they didn't know his face. They don't had a clue in the 70s how this guy looks like.
Mm. That's amazing. Yeah, it wouldn't be like that now, I'm assuming. But that
depending on how many selfies he did.
Oh dear! And the one other interesting thing as well, like the services sort of started with only like 6 intelligence officers, and it grew to something like 90 in a very short period. That was quite interesting.
Yeah, the Soviet KGB had his position in the district of Karlshorst in Berlin, and as you said, they started with only 6 intelligence officers, and then in a couple of years they rose it to 90. And when the KGB was founded in 1954, it took over full control of this international espionage. And but they still had an internal problem. And the internal problem was that the Soviet intelligence, and we learned that during the Berlin blockade, they sent reports back to Moscow who not necessarily fit with the reality. So two aspects. Rather, they anticipated that those in the Soviet capital wanted to hear. Or on the other hand, they just don't want to risk that they were the ones who present bad news, especially when it comes to Joseph Stalin, who was not known for his kindness. So that's a problem the KGB had at the time.
Yeah, it's very dangerous when your spies are effectively just sending back information the way you want to hear it. It gives you a false perspective. And unfortunately, I mean, that practice did carry on in the 70s and 80s to some extent as well. I remember reading Next Stop Execution by Oleg Gordievsky, and he was saying all the officers are kind of trained to write reports in a very particular way to sort of favour certain views back home. So it's... That practice continued on.
I think that's a problem most intelligence services have, that they have informants who are either writing what they expect the other side or their superiors wanted to hear, or they just make up stories because they cannot deliver. You know, they are getting paid and they cannot deliver. So what are they going to do? Yeah. So just inventing stuff.
Yeah, yeah. There's a great, you know, the famous novel by Graham Greene, Our Man in Havana. It's very much like that.
Yeah, I met Oleg Gordievsky in Berlin when we had a meeting with in Berlin at the former listening station Teufelsberg. It was the CIA Historical Department and the Allied Museum who did a huge intelligence conference. And guys like Oleg Gordievsky were there, Peter Sichel was there, and all the big old names of East and West espionage were at the Teufelsberg. That was a great thing. Yeah.
Excellent. Oh my goodness. Yeah. What a day. I met Oleg Gordievsky myself many, many years ago. He used to be, when I was a teenager, I used to work in a supermarket and he used to be one of my regular customers. So I used to sell him salmon, which seems very spyish.
I also met Kalugin, and Kalugin had a very interesting story on the Teufelsberg on those early days. I just have to tell that story.
Please, yeah.
So Kalugin said when a CIA guy, a young man from the CIA office in Berlin, married, they sent a photographer to the church. And the story is that he took a lot of photos from the guys and put them together and said, who are you? So I can give you the images and stuff like this. And when they went into the church and a lot of people approached the CIA guy and said, well, by the way, when the photos from your photographer outside are ready, don't forget to send me my copies. And the guy said, I didn't hire a photographer. And that's the way how you put a face to your name.
Yeah.
You send a photographer to a church because who would a guy working in a CIA office would invite to his wedding in Berlin? Obviously, people who work with him.
Mm.
So that was a funny story. Yeah.
That's brilliant. Oh, I love that. That's... And did they keep the photos and give them to him later on?
No, well, the photographer was obviously from the KGB, and everybody was posing for him, and he said, "Can you two get together, and what's your name, and can you please get here?" Then when they approached the CIA guy and asked him about the copies, and he said, "I didn't hire anyone," and obviously the photographer was gone when they got outside.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. That's brilliant. Well, one of the first sort of big crises that the Western intelligence had to face after World War II was the 1948 sort of blockade of Berlin, which led to obviously the famous sort of Berlin airlift. Can you talk to us about that period of time and how it affected the various intelligence services?
Yeah, 48 was a rough time in Germany. And first of all, military governor Lucius de Clay sent a telegram to Washington. That was the 5th of March, 1948, which is known today as a war telegram. But obviously it wasn't. But for the first time, Lucius de Clay, as a military governor in Germany, had somehow a feeling that... a war might break out. And for that reason, the CIA chief, Roscoe Hillenkoetter, only a week later, approached his service, and he had three simple questions. And question one was, will the Soviet deliberately provoke a war in the next 30 days? Second question, in the next 60 days? And third question, in 1948? And the first two questions, the answer was no, very immediately, and they needed a while to have an answer for the third question, if maybe a provoked war would break out in 48, which in April they say it will not happen. But a couple of months later, the Soviet Union stepped out of the four-power control council, which is dealing with Germany as a whole. And a couple of weeks later, they stepped out of the Allied Kommandatura, which is dealing with all the things for Berlin. So on the administration level, there was no Soviet partner anymore. And because of the currency reform that was done in the western parts of Germany, and that was essential for the economy, and after the Americans and the British combined their zones to the B zone, and a couple of months later the French joined in, they knew they need a new currency, which is worth the money. And they had a new currency in the Western powers, and it was not planned, but all of a sudden they say, the Western forces said, they would introduce this new currency also in West Berlin. And that is the reason why the Soviets wanted, first of all, I think, the simple reason is they wanted to keep the new currency out. Otherwise, they would have had two currencies in Berlin, which they had for a short period because of the blockade. But nevertheless, that was a direct reaction of this new currency reform in West Germany. And that was a Berlin blockade, and all land, water and railway lines to Berlin and from Berlin were blocked. And no one could get in or could get out. And so the Allies reacted with a Berlin airlift. So concerning intelligence, the stuff with the currency reform happened within days, less than a week. That all culminated in the blockade. So the intelligence actually had no chance to do any forecasts what will happen. And keep in mind that blocking roads is a passive action. I think they were not even prepared to look at those passive activities. More, they were looking more at active things. And but active things during the blockade didn't happen. So the passive thing was to just to block all rail, water, and block all ways to Berlin. And so the only way remaining are the air corridors. And as we all know, that was a huge success for the Western powers, who were able, after a couple of weeks, they were able to supply all of West Germany, and it went better and better. And after a couple of months, they were able to transport more goods via these air corridors than they were before. They came in before on the road or on the rail. So that was amazing. That was amazing. Logistically amazing was that.
Yeah, no, indeed. And there were some opportunities for aerial espionage, which kind of continued on beyond the Berlin airlift. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Well, during the Berlin airlift, they actually started not only to send planes with food and coal into Berlin, but they also sent reconnaissance planes in those three Allied corridors to take photographs, because all the aerial, most, let's say 60% of the ground underneath the airplanes was the Soviet zone, later became the GDR. And they did not even land in Berlin. They just fly the corridor, turn around, and fly back. taking good photos. So they continued that bunch for lunch to Berlin activities approximately twice a week until German unification.
Wow.
So for more than 40 years, the Allies were flying the corridor, and probably for more than 40 years, this is the best documented territory in the world. If you take photos of the same places twice a week, you know, and that's for more than 40 years.
Yeah.
These are a lot of shots, yeah.
Yeah, gosh, it sadly sort of reminds me of Ukraine a little bit, because I've got this app on my phone called Flight Radar 24 where you can see obviously aircraft activity, and one of the things that you can see is some of the Western spy planes occasionally. So you get things like the drones, the Global Hawks, you get the Rivet Joint, which is the big sort of spy plane, and so when I was reading about the espionage during Berlin airlift, I was just like, wow, you know, that practice has got its roots back even then. So. It's fantastic.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
We'll move on to the foundation of the two German republics. So you've got the Federal Republic of Germany, which was in the west, and the German Democratic Republic in the east. And in your book, you sort of talk about French and British intelligence activities during this time. Can you talk to us about what you discovered? And I guess we'll start with French intelligence.
Well, the French intelligence had a hard start because they had to go underground during the German occupation of France. And they have to develop and were founded in January 1946. And it's called the Service de Documentation Extérieure et de Contre-Espionnage, SDECE. And they were formed in 1946, and they had two branches, and one branch was based in Saigon, Vietnam, to deal with the military problems they had there with their former colonies.
Yeah.
And later on, they were, you know, there. When the Allies were flying planes to Berlin, the French did not really take part in this flying because they were in a military conflict down there and needed all their planes. They didn't have many planes, but the ones they had, they needed for their conflict in 1948 down in the southeast. And the second base of this intelligence service was indeed stationed in Germany in Baden-Baden. And they should deal with the role of the French in the coming Cold War in Europe. And as the British and the Americans and the Soviets, actually in the very early post-war years, all four intelligence services were aiming at German scientists. French did the same. But later on, I have to outline that at the end, the Americans and the Soviets were the most successful ones doing that.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, the French were also trying that, as well as the British, who had the longest history concerning political espionage organizations that went well long back. But after World War II, the SIS conducted operations in West Berlin. And again, they were trying to aim at German scientists and to persuade them to come to Great Britain and work for Great Britain. And to some extent, they were successful. I think at the end, by November 1949, the British had convinced at least 332 scientists to leave the Soviet zone and go not especially to Great Britain, but at least in their zone in West Germany to work for them. And having these 332 in mind, I said the Americans were more successful. They were able to persuade approximately 1,000 scientists to come and go into the United States. And the most prominent figure is probably Wernher von Braun, who became the deputy of the NASA, which is incredible because he, to be honest, Wernher von Braun was a Nazi.
Yeah,
let's face it.
Yeah, yeah, he was in the SS, wasn't he?
And he was working for the regime and doing everything he could. And yeah, that gives you an idea how denazification worked after Second World War, when everybody was aiming for the knowledge and not regarding what they did before.
I don't know why it popped into my head. When I traveled to America in the 90s, you used to have to fill in this form, and on there you have to declare if you were a former Nazi from World War II. obviously for some people that was the problem.
I don't think that Wernher von Braun filled in that form.
No, I don't think he did. I mean, it's basically, I mean, just for maybe some audience members who are not 100% up on what German scientists were specialists in, but Wernher von Braun was obviously the rocket specialist, wasn't he? He was the man behind the V1 and V2 rocket. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And not him. Not he alone. He had a couple of co-workers, and a couple of them just went with him to United States, and he needed those guys he worked with at Peenemünde for the V2, as well as now then in America for their space system.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, and obviously jet engines as well, and you know, the sort of ICBM, intercontinental ballistic missile technology, I'm sure has its roots in this sort of research for both the Russians and the Americans.
Well, the Russian approach for these scientists was different. They do not persuade those people; they just collected them, plus their families. And put them into trucks, put them into trains, and transported them to Russia. And they had to work there between 3 and 5 years for Russia in the scientific field. But after that time, they were free to leave the country, go back to East Germany or wherever they want. But this was, it was not a persuasion, let's say, by money or by freedom or by freedom of science, whatever you have. So they just collected them, picked them up, including their families, brought them to Russia and kept them there for between 2, 3, or 5 years. And then they were set free and they could go wherever they want to. But, you know, indeed, a couple of the scientists stayed after that time in Russia. Another good bunch went back to East Germany.
Yeah. Yeah. Did any ever make it back to the West and sort of get turned?
They could. They could, yes. There were some who could do that. You know, if you were in East Germany in the 50s, late 50s, it was not a problem at all to go to West Germany. Indeed, we have, after the uprising in East Germany in 1953, we had an incredible flow of refugees. We were talking about Ukraine refugees nowadays, of course, but I just want to give you one figure. After the East German uprising in 1953, that was you know, shut down by Russian tanks, literally nearly 300,000 East Germans came to West Berlin, not to West Germany, into the city of West Berlin in 1 year. So remember what incredible stroke for the city of West Berlin that was, coping with 300, this is 10%, more than 10% of your population comes as refugee in just in 1 year. And we all have this refugee problematic in Europe in 2015 in mind. Now the Ukraine refugees that were distributed to several countries, to Poland, to Yugoslavia, and a lot of people are taking those refugees, Germany as well. But those 300,000 exclusively came to West Berlin, which is a major problem also for the Allies, because the intelligence were trying to interview every single refugee. They had an office, and all refugees had to go through those intelligence allied offices. And in there, they were asked what they did in East Germany, if they had any relation to the Russian forces whatsoever. And if they had, the Allies were trying to persuade them to go back on the same day before it was noticed they were missing. And believe it or not, in quite a couple of cases, they were successful and sent those, I would say, stupid young men back to East Germany to work for them as, you know, quote, agents. But the fate of those people who went back is usually has no happy ending.
Yeah, watch Bridge of Spies for that.
Yeah. There were no trained spies, nothing, you know. And after the war was erected, they even had no contact to any of the leading officers in West Berlin. So that's one thing. This refugee flee of refugees is connected to intelligence. On the other hand, we learned later that quite a few prominent spies came as a refugee to West Germany. So people who later worked in West German administration, stuff like this, and also in big companies and firms, they came as a normal refugee in the 50s, were flown out from West Berlin to West Germany, had the job there, and were good in their jobs, were promoted, and only after the collapse of East Germany, we noticed that quite a few of those refugees in those early 50s were working as spies, actually.
Yeah. One really interesting piece of spy history that was unique to Berlin is the Berlin Spy Tunnel. And you also have a connection to a special documentary that was made about the Berlin Spy Tunnel for George Blake's 90th birthday. Do you want to talk to us about both the tunnel and your experience with this Russian documentary?
Well, the Berlin Spy Tunnel, I would call a perfect example for espionage activities in Berlin. It has it all. And starting with the historical aspect, I told you that Vienna was a blueprint for listening to Soviet communication. And they thought what's possible in Vienna is obviously also possible in Berlin. And they were looking for a place from where they could dig a tunnel from West Berlin to East Berlin, knowing exactly where the telephone lines in East Berlin are, because the Soviet Union is using the old German Reich telephone communication lines. So they knew exactly where they had to tap in. So that's the plan, and so what they did, that's what they did. And the British, who did the listening in Vienna, brought in the Americans into the boat for simple reason. The operation was so expensive that the British could not afford it.
Yeah.
You know, Great Britain at the end of the Second World War was on the knees, economically on the knees, and you even had food rationing until the early 50s, I guess.
Yeah. My dad used to talk a lot about that. Yes.
Yeah, and so obviously they could not pay for such an expensive operation that started in 1953, and the overall costs were, you know, you will laugh now, it was $6.7 million.
Yeah.
Which today is a joke. But at the time, that was a lot of money. For a single operation in West Berlin, you need to spend $6.7 million. So the Americans were willing to do that. So it was a combined operation. And unfortunately, really, in Great Britain, not more than a handful of people knew about it. And one of those handful was, unfortunately, a guy who was taking minutes for one of those meetings, and that was George Blake. And what nobody knew at the time is that George Blake was working for the Russians, for the KGB. And a couple of the very first meeting in 1953, George Blake met his leading officer, General Kondratchev, and he told him about the tunnel. And so the KGB knew about the tunnel even before it was built.
In the
planning phase, they knew about it. And then the KGB decided, had to decide what to do with the tunnel. So they had two options, either to protect their new top spy in the British administration, which is George Blake, or to ruin the tunnel or the plans for building the tunnel. And they decided to protect their new top spy. So the tunnel was planned. It took them more than a year to build the tunnel, and the tunnel was 5 meters deep. It was more than 400 meters long. And the aim were three major telephone lines at the end of those 400 meters. And this technical bit was done by British specialists and experts. They did the tapping of the of these telephone lines. And after that, they had access to nearly 300 single telephone numbers and the conversations in there. The tunnel was in operation for 11 months, and during those 11 months, they taped more than 400,000 telephone conversations. Even though the Russian knew about it, they did not put false information through the tunnel. Because I had learned that from those intelligence guys. General Kondratchev said at the museum, it's far too complicated to produce good false information.
Yeah, especially to that volume, I guess. You talk about 300 phone conversations, that's a lot of people.
Exactly. So they said the risk is too high, and as soon as they know there's fake news going through the tunnel, they knew there is a mole somewhere, and then they risk George Blake. So that's not the thing they're doing. But even though the tunnel was found on purpose, and it was exactly the date when Nikita Khrushchev was on his first state visit to Great Britain. They were talking about the Suez Crisis, a really hard military crisis at the time. And Khrushchev said, discover the tunnel when I am in Great Britain. That gives him, obviously, a bit more space for negotiations. And what happened after the tunnel was discovered, in all the newspapers, exclusively, the Americans were blamed for the tunnel. And that is because Nikita Khrushchev said, discover the tunnel when I'm in Great Britain, and blame the Americans. And we even have an original Soviet document for East German administration in Russian. Document is in Russian, and the document says exactly what the East Germans had to do when they discovered the tunnel. And one point is that they should exclusively blame the Americans for the tunnel. And that has a background, is that, as I said, Nikita Khrushchev is in Great Britain at the time. Yes, and then after the tunnel was found, the CIA was pretty certain that was pure accident, because at the time it was raining and one line was very unstable, and they were so clever. The technicians they sent to the area to find the broken telephone cable while it was raining so hard, they had no clue. they were digging and digging and digging, and after a while they found the tunnel. And they had some microphones, the CIA had microphones inside of the tunnel, so they can hear what the technicians were talking. And obviously the technicians had no clue what was this steel tube. Yeah. It was a listening station, underground listening station. So they informed the Soviet officers and back and forth. And everybody who was coming had no clue what that is. And that on the other side, on the CIA side, gave the impression that indeed the tunnel was not found on purpose, but it was pure accident that they found the tunnel. Mm. But later, many years later, when George Blake confessed that he was a spy for the KGB, it was obvious that he told the British that he was the mole, and that he told the KGB about the tunnel. And after that, the tunnel had not a good reputation, because everybody thought the false thought that a false information was sent through the tunnel, which indeed did not happen. So then Blake was imprisoned. He managed to escape out of the prison in Great Britain. He fled to East Germany. In East Germany, he went to Russia, in Moscow. He was regarded as one of the heroes of the KGB until he died very 95 or something, or 96 even he got. He lived as a persona grata of the KGB. He was always regarded as one of those heroes. And that is the reason why Vladimir Putin himself said he wanted to see a history documentary on George Blake and what he did for the Soviet Union for his 90th birthday. And he wanted to show it on this very well-known first Russian program. So a TV team from Russia came to Berlin and they hired me and I showed them everything. And after 3 days, they said they learned much more about this tunnel operation than they learned in Moscow, because they had no access to any kind of archive in Moscow. And that was amazing for me. Now, how can they do a documentary on George Blake without having any access to any archive in the Soviet Union?
That's crazy. So, yeah. Yeah. They don't even have spy books in Russia. Gosh. Oh, my goodness. And I'm assuming you haven't met Putin or George Blake, have you?
No, George Blake, I haven't met. But he gave a couple of interviews, and he nearly turned blind when he's 90. And George Blake did not work for the Soviet Union and the KGB because he needed money, but because he thought he was working for the wrong side. So he's more or less a socialist or even a communist, and he remained that until his death. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it was in Korea, wasn't it? The Korean War. He turned, I think.
That's right.
Yeah.
He was imprisoned during the Korean War, and during his imprisonment, he, for himself, he decided he's working for the wrong side, and then via the North Korean, he offered his service to the Russians. And ironically, when he came back to Great Britain a couple of years later, he was even sent to Berlin, because he was a genius concerning languages. He could speak 5 languages fluently, including Russian. And he was sent to Berlin in the 50s to recruit East Germans as agents. So funny, yeah. So that's the reason why George Blake was even stationed in West Berlin for several months there.
Thank you for everything about the spy tunnel. Was there anything else you wanted to add about the spy tunnel before we move on to the Berlin Wall?
Well, at the Allied Museum, for many, many, many years, we had the only original segment of the spy tunnel. We digged it out in Berlin, where after the German unification, when they built a housing area at the place where the spy tunnel was. And that was amazing. And then we digged out another piece, and with this historical information, we were in the newspapers worldwide. So San Francisco Chronicle, Italian newspapers worldwide, because we discovered a couple of other original pieces of the spy tunnel very deep in former East Germany. And the reason for that is when the East Germans wanted to get rid of the spy tunnel, we thought, honestly, and I know the CIA thought as well, because I have contacts there, and they had no clue about the spy tunnel being rediscovered in East Germany. So what the East Germans did when they want to get rid of the spy tunnel, I told you it's 400 meters, a very a steel tube with a diameter of 1.9 meters. So a normal man could go through the steel tube. And this is for 400 meters. So you have a lot of steel there. And what they did, they reused it as shelters for their maneuvers in the forest. So pieces of the steel tube for 3 and 4 meter segments were cut into, they cut those pieces and they digged them into the forest and used them as headquarters for their maneuvers in the forest for the pioneers. So all over, and they sent those steel segments all over East Germany.
To work recycling, that's very good.
And we had no clue. CIA had no clue. Allied Museum had no clue. We all thought that East Germany probably melted these tons and tons and tons of good steel, and reused it for their own purpose. They did reuse it, but for military purpose, being military stands for their pioneers. And that was an incredible message, and that came in 2006, I guess. We got this information.
Wow. Is some of it in the Spy Museum in Washington now? I've lost track of where those bits are.
It is. Everybody wanted to have a segment of this spy tunnel, but we just had two huge pieces and we didn't want to give one away. But when we discovered that in East Germany there are more original segments of the spy tunnel digged in the forest, we digged some out for the Spy Museum in Washington, indeed. So besides the Allied Museum in Berlin, the Spy Museum in Washington is the only museum in the world that has another huge piece of the original spy tunnel in Berlin, yeah.
Excellent. Well, two places to go and check it out, so that's brilliant. Excellent. Well, let's look at the Berlin Wall. So the next major hurdle for Western intelligence and the citizens of Berlin was the Berlin Wall being constructed in 1961. Can you talk to us about this and sort of what it how it sort of created challenges for Western intelligence?
The Berlin Wall was a game changer. Keep in mind that before the wall was erected, every person in West Berlin as well as in East Berlin could cross the border anytime, as often as they wanted to. So that was no problem at all. So people could go backwards and forwards whenever they want. You can meet people in the other part of the city. You can talk to people in the other part of the city. You can meet in the public. You can meet secretly in a forest, wherever you want to. Obviously, you can imagine that this is the land of milk and honey if you are working in the intelligence business. But when the wall was erected, this was completely over. Yeah, so East Germans, no way for any East German to go from east to west again. And it was also pretty complicated, or I wouldn't say impossible but unusual for military personnel to go to East Germany. They go there for shopping, they go there for sightseeing, they're going there in the opera, but not for several days. That would be suspicious. If you leave the group and you will be followed, it's very risky. If you go there in your, and you have to go to East Germany in your uniform. And obviously, if you're going in your uniform, it's easy to, you know, to recognize you, easy to follow you. And then you risk the life of the guy you're going to meet with. So that makes no sense. So Berlin Wall was the game changer. But the Berlin Tunnel a couple of years before in 55 showed already that they transformed intelligence work from human intelligence, which is meeting your opponent in the West or in the East, to the technical intelligence, which the tunnel was, by listening to the telephone conversation. And that's what happened in the years that are coming. They were spending much more money into technical devices, into listening stations like the Teufelsberg, like Marienfelde, like in Tempelhof and in Gattau. You have a couple of listening stations that were able to listen deep into Moscow, into the Soviet Union. And they spent a lot of money into that because the human factor was no longer that important because of the Berlin Wall. That's indeed a game changer. And talking about intelligence, yes, indeed, they were surprised somehow. There had been hints and there had been messages by individuals. But we know all that now, after months, years, and decades later. It is obvious that there had been hints that something would happen. And even the political leaders knew that I mentioned all the refugees from East Germany to West Germany. And even the American leader knew, Kennedy, that something will happen and that the East Germans had to stop this refugee, bleeding out East Germany. It's all the young people that are leaving, not the old ones. The young people you need for the future of the country, those are the ones who are leaving. And everybody knew they had to stop this somehow. But I think they were not aware that it was so brutal and so long-lasting like the Berlin Wall.
Yeah. What effect did the Berlin Wall have on Russian intelligence? Did it have any effect?
Well, more or less the same on the Western intelligence. The exchange of people going back and forth, going from the East to the West, from the West to the East, was only possible for diplomats. And, as I said, for individuals in uniforms. And it also limited the possibilities of the other side. But I think the benefit is definitely on the Western part, on the Eastern part, because they were able to stop this refugees going from East to West.
Yeah, it was a lot more kind of clamped down. So yeah. Bernard, thank you so much for your time today. Where can listeners find out more about you and your work?
Well, I mentioned I'm working at the Allied Museum, and our webpage is bilingual, so whoever wants to click in the webpage of the Allied Museum in Berlin, he's free to do so. And also, I mentioned the book. It's called Capital of Spies, and Casemate is the publisher. And as I said, it is a good overview to get an idea what kind of activities happened in Berlin, not only in the western part, that was my part, but also in East Germany with the Staatssicherheit and the activities that were going on there. So it's a good overview, and whoever is interested in a single story then can go further and see if there are any books especially on that one subject. But we were trying to present a larger scale and a better overview.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, thank you again for joining me today.
Thank you, Chris.
Listening. This is Secrets and Spies.
KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms. At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.